And the white man is the boldest creature on this planet. The white man has more nerve than the fucking toothache. That's why you can go to space and do all that shit. You will crawl into a can of beans. I get in. Because I saw a special, you know, early in the morning, like 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, when you think niggas are asleep, I'm up. They have specials on white men do crazy shit. I saw a white man in a cage deep in the ocean fucking with a big old white shark. That shit was scary. Just, and the shark just kept hitting the guy. The white man was down there just freaking. They brought him up and shit, interviewed him. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Marvelous. The shark was white, I was white, there was no niggas I loved. That's some funny, wild-ass bullshit. Because you guys do things that niggas won't do, and that white folks are nosy. They have specials, nosy specials. Why does a bee make honey? You ain't a bee, why do you give a fuck? Following in a butterfly to Mexico, just crazy shit. Nosy. That's why you can go to the moon and shit. They tell me they sent a black girl somewhere, didn't they? They said they sent a black girl up there, but I didn't never hear them say they brought that bitch back. Because didn't they send the married couple? I saw them on the news. I ain't seen that black woman. There's a coon on the moon in June. The jig is up. Shit was cold. I hope they bring that bitch back. Because didn't Russia leave somebody up there? They sent somebody up there. They was too broke. They couldn't bring this motherfucker back. Because the country fell apart. The economist, he called it back, Conrad, Conrad. They said, I'm sorry, he's moved. He went to America, Conrad. Some cold shit. But it is. It's, but white people do that. You do wild stuff. That's it. And I'm now that we're all friends. And I want to ask white folks, why do you guys take your children to places where they can get attacked and eaten and shit? I'm tired of picking up paper reading about some little white child carried off by a bear, a mountain lion, some coyotes, wolves. You take your kids. You never read about black kids being taken away by some wild shit. You guys are freaks for doing that shit. And then when the bear gets your kids, you try to get all psychological. What motivated the bear? The bear was hungry. Your child looked like a hamburger. That's what's the motivation. And you shouldn't have been out there in the woods. Y'all are crazy. Let your kids play in the eagle's nest. Play with the eggs. You know the eagle coming back to fuck them up.
Well, we're off to a whiz-bang Wednesday. Wotan's Day. David Lane's favorite day. Yeah. With my favorite nigger. He is my favorite nigger racist. I forgot his name. I'm sorry about my short-term memory. But he has no problem talking about niggers. He does it with every joke. Well, let's start off with a bulletin from our good buddy Stray Dog back in New Germany. Hi, TT. I found out about this intel a few days ago and wanted to pass it along to you and your listeners. Governor Chris Christie, a.k.a. Big Tony, will assume the role of Attorney General, replacing Jeff Sessions, when Christie's term as governor expires in January 2018. Reason Christie stayed on as the governor of New Jersey is to block legislation legalizing the use and sale of marijuana. Big deal. The New Jersey legislature has already lined up the paperwork for legalization for the next governor to sign in January 2018. We will see some real fireworks when Chris Christie battles the press corps and others. Can't wait. Good to be with you. With admiration, Stray Dog from New Germany. I hope you're right. I'd love to see Chris Christie as the Attorney General. Did you see the other day? I think I sent that to you, where he crawled into the face of a baseball fan. Baseball fan gave him some shit at a baseball game, and he waddled right up there and got in his face nose to nose. I like that. I like that in a man. Sometimes even a woman. Boy, I'm shocked. This news just coming across the board. Wow. Just a minute here. three New York City men. What's going on here? What's going on? Let's try that again. Three New York City men are accused of running a fraud ring. Got a taste of small town justice today. Marvin Silver, Demetrius Cummings, and David Duke were arrested and charged with conspiracy to commit larceny at the UPS facility on Kimball Lane Friday. Well, that can't be the David Duke I know, Plastic Man. No, that couldn't be. I noticed the news is full of another David Duke playing basketball. He's getting most of the press now. Yeah, he's getting a lot more press than the Great White Hope, Plastic Man. And then there's a sheriff, David Duke, running around. He's always doing something. I'm surprised any nigger woman would name her kid after David Duke, the Ku Klux Klansman. If you want to drop down and see that David Duke, he's at 107-34 126th Street in Queens, New York. And there you go. Now, Duke has never been a common name, so it's really weird how these niggers are calling their kids, naming them David Duke. Well, it looks like the alt-right has a problem in the White House. Chief of Staff John Kelly is, by all accounts, imposing more discipline in the Trump White House. But a mini-drama last week shows there's still more cleanup duty to be done. To wit, notice the alt-right brigades who seem to rise up as if one called to smite some White House policy opponent of aide Steve Bannon. Whoa! There was the Great White Hope of Steve Bannon. But you don't know all his background. I'm going to run it for you one of these days. The latest target has been H.R. McMaster's, the three-star general who took over as National Security Advisor after President Trump fired Michael Flynn. Lieutenant General McMaster has come in for abuse for favoring more troops and a new strategy in Afghanistan. That's all we need in Afghanistan. But really all we need is insecticide to kill all those poppy plants. That's about the only reason they're over there. Some oil, too. For warning that Vladimir Putin is no friend of America. Well, he's a friend of Russia. He's not elected to be the friend of the United States. He obviously would prefer to make a deal, I guess, with the United States and vice versa. Should make life easier, but Putin is a Russian, interested in the well-being of Russian people. And for advising Mr. Trump not to precipitously withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal. Well, I would agree with that. He also recently dismissed some NSC staff members who were brought on by Mr. Flynn and are said to be allies of Mr. Bannon. Uh-oh. Whoa, the allegedly racist, which is he probably is if he needs it, but if he don't need it, he don't use it. Policy brawls are routine in any White House, and Lieutenant General McMaster's can surely handle his corner. The issue of Mr. Kelly and Mr. Trump as to what to do with disagreement inside the White House when it turns to vilification of his staff from the outside. Somehow, the Bannon brigades outside the White House decided to assail the general as insufficiently pro-Israel. Oh, there's a good right-wing conservative. And not hostile enough to the Islamic State, among other calumnies. The latter is especially preposterous since the Colonel McMaster developed the counterinsurgency strategy in Tal Afar that was the prototype for the 2007 surge that won the Iraq War. Well, there you go. what's going to happen to the fake racist Bannon? Mr. Trump issued a statement of support for Lieutenant General McMaster's late on Friday, which in a better White House would settle the matter. But rather than question the general's loyalties, perhaps Mr. Kelly should question Mr. Bannon's. The former Breitbart publisher has been a White House survivor, but his warring habits have also been responsible for much of the White House dysfunction. Mr. Trump may worry about the damage Mr. Bannon and his allies, the conservatives, could do to his administration if he no longer is a part of the White House team. But if his minions continue to vilify his colleagues inside the White House, how can anyone tell the difference? Well, that's a Wall Street Journal, which you can't believe hardly anything they say. But I would submit and think that maybe Mr. Bannon's days are numbered in the White House, which is going to severely upset the alt-right. Well, Mike Pence, the ex-Indiana governor, they're claiming is going to try to run for president. New York Times says it. Pence denies it. But I think he's a liar. He said a lot of lies in Indiana when I was there. And he's got this giant Eli Lilly drug company behind him. One of the biggest drug pushers in the country and the world, turning everybody into a drug addict. Eli Lilly, remember that. If you'll check who's giving all the money to the politicians, you'll find they give a lot of money out. Well, anyhow, amid White House staff changes, the vice president has replaced his long-serving chief of staff with sharp-elbowed political operative Nick Ayers. That might indicate something there as far as him running for president in 3 years. Well, anyhow, we'll see what happens there. I didn't care for him in Indiana, and I know I wouldn't care for him as vice president, and I really wouldn't care for him as president. I don't care for anybody as president. As far as I'm concerned, you could do away with president altogether. Maybe run it like a troika, like the Russians did for a while. Anyhow, all governments are oligarchies anyhow, ruled by the few. That's all they are. Veteran political operative Ayers had for months been quietly warning the vice president that Trump's troubles could cause collateral damage, that he needed to take a more aggressive posture on a range of issues to ensure he enters the post-Trump era on solid ground, according to two White House officials. Yeah. Interesting that Mueller, the special counsel they put in there to investigate Trump, gave up a $3.5 million deal since the beginning of 2016. And that's only part of it. Why would he do that? Obviously because he's been promised big money on the downside. Well, a nitwit over there in Israel's got a problem. It's getting worse. Israel's embattled Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, lashed out at the media and his political opponents in an animated speech to hundreds of enthusiastic supporters on Wednesday, seeking to deliver a powerful show of force as he battles a slew of corruption allegations that have threatened to drive him from office. Netanyahu's Likud party organized Wednesday rally in response to a swirling police investigation into suspected corruption, bribery, and fraud by the longtime Jew leader. I thought those Hebrews were such godly people, man. Well, here's a shocker. John Bailey has been elected president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. The Academy announced on Tuesday a white man. 74-year-old cinematographer was chosen. Other officers elected to the board meeting were Lewis Burwell, first vice president, and so on. Well, that's interesting. I wonder how white he is.
Good morning, John Montone on Rat Patrol. Do you know that there are, well, not counting notorious mafia snitches like Sammy the Bull Gravano, there are 2 million rats in New York City, and quite a few of them apparently have developed a taste for the finer things in life because they've moved here to the Upper West Side, where the local assemblywoman, Linda Rosenthal, says they are menacing mommies and daddies and nannies in Central Park and over on the West Side, Riverside Park, by jumping into baby strollers in search of a snack. One fellow told 1010 Winds, the rats are everywhere. And a dog walker says he sees armies of huge rodents on parade through the parks. That being the case, the assemblywoman wants a chunk of the city's $32 million rat reduction fund sent up here to eradicate the rodents. There is one problem, however. You can't use rat poison around here because it might also eradicate the neighborhood's beloved red-tailed hawks. John Montone, 1010 Winds, on Rat Patrol.
Well, that's a what a revolt development that is. That's not in the poor part of town. That's in the rich part of town. The rats are so plentiful, they're jumping out of the trees into the baby carriages. Wow. That's New York. The Big Apple. With a bite out of it. So New York City is not going to the dogs, it's going to the rats. That's fitting. Back in 1998, Colin Jordan from Great Britain, the National Socialist leader and friend and confidant of George Lincoln Rockwell, wrote a little article that probably wasn't too popular with a lot of people in England. Remember when Princess Diana got in a wreck and was killed? There's a lot of questions about that wreck and about her screwing that Arab guy. What was his name? I can't remember his name right now. Just because his father was a super rich guy. That's the way it works, you know. Diana Daphnis by Colin Jordan. Was September a strange fit of madness came and gripped Britain for several weeks, convulsing the public at large with a high fever of hysteria. Scribes penned soaring and saintly eulogies. Flower sellers enjoyed their bonanza of their lives. Souvenir makers made a fortune. A depraved drink and drug homosexual named Elton John, who appropriately performed as a people's star at the funeral in Westminster Abbey of a people's potentate, sold millions of records of his pop production. The Queen interrupted her summer sojourn at Balmoral to return to London to broadcast to the nation. A minute's silence was observed far and wide. Suggestions for commemoration encompassed an eternal flame, specially named Bank Holiday, the minted of new coins, the renaming of Heathrow Airport, the permanent closing to traffic of London's leading thoroughfare, the Mall, and the award of a Nobel Peace Prize. The passing of what great person occasioned this extravaganza of the century? What stirred the press, pulpit, and public to such a frenzy of adulation and hullabaloo of grief? It was not the death of some giant nobility after a lifelong labor for the benefit and betterment of Britain. not a manifestation of concern for the fate of our race and nation in the face of present destructive trends, not an awakening of reverence for the millions in past times who have truly served the community or died to keep Britain for the British. Instead, this fantastic convulsion of a nation was caused by the death in a car accident of a comparatively worthless young woman who, born into luxury and idleness, can hardly have ever done a hard day's work in her life. Hers was a death caused by a lack of sufficient common sense in concern for herself and her children, as not to be wearing a seat belt when allowing herself to be driven at up to 100 miles an hour or more, around three times the speed limit in that part of central Paris, by a drunken driver who was more than three times over the drink driving limit, and moreover taking medications impairing his driving ability. The Diana Daphnis, as we have made dub the public response to this appalling irresponsibility, was the truly weird canonization of a deeply unstable, indeed mentally ill, character subject to tantrums, in the course of which one occasion she threw herself downstairs when pregnant, thus endangering her future heir to the throne, subject to the derangement known as anorexia, namely a disposition to starve herself, subject to the inclination to suicide as shown by the attempt at Sandringham, and subject to an indulgence in the self-mutilation as a symptom of severe mental disturbance, as reported in the London Daily Telegraph, July 13, 1996. At school, this glossy idol of the gaping masses had failed five of her zero levels, and but for her plutocratic background and chance elevation to royalty, could have failed to qualify for a checkout job at a supermarket. She was notably a shallow person, devoted to pleasure and display devoid of cultural attainment. Her musical level, for instance, being that of a rock concert she attended and jumped up and down at her favorite pop group, having been one popular with the phonetic youngsters known as the Teeny Boppers. Violating fidelity like her husband Charles, as a rotten example to the nation, this candidate for sainthood indulged in an adulterous affair with an army officer and another one with a riding instructor, not to mention any more. Before her demise, the ensuing suspension of criticism, the London Sunday Telegraph, August 16, 1997, said her sexual rovings, that she always ends with a second-class riff-raff like James Hewitt or dullards like Christopher Whaley. With her image in danger of resolving accurately into no more than that of a pretty, entirely playful princess, she entrusted herself to and was taken over by professional image makers, particularly and principally the Jewish Susie Orbach, a feminist guru and psychotherapist, and given a year-long series of training sessions, thrice weekly with her. The outcome was fast, forced, synthetic presentation of a new, caring princess of hearts. She contrived to be pictured fussing with colored children in Brixton and elsewhere, shaking the hands with AIDS patients at Middlesex Hospital and elsewhere, and opening a drug center in Glasgow, thus winning fans from the scum of society and emerging as a queen of queers and drug addicts. She was even shown pushing herself before the TV cameras she had brought into the Harefield Hospital, London, operating theater so she could portray concern for a Negro boy brought from Africa for a heart operation, before which she had taken care to be seen kissing and cuddling him. While this pop star princess of artificially made out when she had an overdose of it, that she was hounded and driven to desperation by the media, and it was initially declared after her fatal accident that she had been brought to it by pursuing paparazzi. The fact is that she was a publicly addict who pursued and played with the media whenever it suited her for gratification of her vanity. She tipped off the press whenever she fancied their presence. She approached editors on occasion seeking attention. She supplied material to the media through friends. She paraded in front of them at impromptu press conferences. With her eager connivance, the media profitably transformed a non-entity into a constant front-page feature, so much so that she came to fancy herself as a special ambassador for Blair's Britain, and he was moved towards making her such. Her charitable disposition, as far as her own pocket was concerned, was put in question by her extravagance regarding personal adornment. She was reported as expending £100,000 on clothes for a trip to Italy in the 1980s, and £80,000 on clothes for a trip to Saudi Arabia and other neighboring places in the same decade. Her dress at a charity ball in New York the year before she died cost £10,000. Her total expenditure on clothes alone during her performances as Tinsel Princess of Compassion must have run into millions. If she had been less of a show-off, she could have benefited her showcase charities by personal donation in place of some of this luxury. Our Diana of Decadence not only put herself into Jewish hands with her backstage mentor Susie Orbach, she was surrounded by Jewish friends and confidants, among them Jewish film producer David Putnam, banker Lord Jacob Rothschild, the Jewish editor of the Sunday Telegraph, Dominic Lawson, and his wife Rosa, president of the jewelers Tiffany and Company, and her lawyer Jew Lord Mishkan. Even Jewess Elizabeth Emanuel designed her wedding dress and clothed her for years, so that in fabric as well as thought she was a Jewish product. In view of who she really was behind the gloss, it can be no real surprise that this playgirl of princess gravitated to an Egyptian playboy, and at the end seemed set as the mother of the future King of England to marry him and become a Muslim. Doty, her final beau, son of Mohammed Fayyad, vastly wealthy owner of Harrods, the huge London store, and the enormously expensive Rich Hotel in Paris, along with other properties and investments, said the total value £1.5 billion, was an utter useless parasite, enormously wealthy with a collection of multi-million pound properties around the world, including a castle in Scottish Highlands, a fleet of cars, an impressive record of philandering, and an ability to gobble down 300-pound tins of caviar. It was not the first time our trumpery princess had gone Asian. Earlier in the year, she had been dancing in the arms of an Asian millionaire, Gula Lavani, and next day the garland and with a Hindu mark on her forehead had a Hindu temple in North London, she had another Asian friend. The reason why Gothic Ripples here expend such an amount of space in summing up and cutting down a size a paltry character who never said and did a single thing for the benefit of our beleaguered race, and who instead was greatly harmful in regularly seeking opportunity to promote colors and race mixing and various other forms of degeneracy. Is that Dinamania following her departure vividly showed the acute stage which our national sickness has now reached. In a milieu where the bulk of the nation seeks to make something of a goddess out of Diana, there is clearly a sense of void in the public mind, a sense of absence of anything of an uplifting national mission in the British, in the Britain government by the likes of Blair. The public responds to this by creating false idols such as pop stars and fairy princesses under the tutelage of a captivating media. The BNP, British National Party, belief that it can detach the public from this enslavement is fond and a fatal illusion. So there you go. That's from our good friend Colin Jordan, who has now passed away. Incidentally, he wrote a good book about an order, a fictional order group in Britain. I've got it here in my library. I forget what it was called, but I think it's still available. So anyhow, there was Colin Jordan trying to do something to wake up the British people, but it's not going to happen. Britain is through. Of course, the whole West is through. It has to totally crash before there's any possibility of maybe, just maybe, rebuilding it. If not, Mother Nature will rebuild it for us. And it'll probably turn out a lot like it turned out in the beginning. But it's going to take a lot longer. I don't know, with global warming and weather change, things could change real fast. And I'm going to be really unhappy if global warming is not a fact. Well, hopefully I've got enough time for this. This is by Dr. William Pierce from Liberty Lobby in February 1998. Slavery and Race. I have before me a news story written by a correspondent for the London Daily Telegraph. It's a story about the flourishing child slavery business in West Africa, in countries like Nigeria, Togo, Benin, and Gabon. Businessmen in the coastal cities send buyers into the interior with buses where they collect surplus children in the 7 to 15-year-old age range and bring them back in groups of 50 to 100. In other words, a busload to the slave markets on the coast. Typically, the buyers pay parents anywhere from $10 to $30 per child. In some areas, they simply bribe local officials to look the other way and kidnap the children without any payment at all. Once in the coastal cities, the children are housed in large supermarket-style buildings where the shoppers can stroll through and select the children they want to buy and pay for their merchandise at the door as they leave. Some of the purchasers send the children out on the streets to work as prostitutes. Others use them as house servants or as factory workers. This is not a small-time thing or an occasional thing. This is a thriving business involving thousands of children bought and sold every year in dozens of slave markets in the West African cities to the region which used to be known as the Slave Coast, because that's where the slave dealers during the 18th and early 19th centuries would buy shiploads of slaves to take to the West Indies and the Americas for plantation work. After slavery was outlawed in Europe and America, it continued as an ongoing institution in Africa, just as it had for countless centuries before white men began to buy African slaves. The only reason Europeans and white Americans ever hear anything about this ongoing African slave trade is that there is a few tender-hearted white groups, such as Amnesty International and Anti-Slavery International, whose sensibilities are offended by this sort of thing. These groups try to arouse public opinion in America and Europe against slavery. They also work through the politicians, trying to persuade them to put anti-slavery amendments into aid agreements with the African countries. As a result of such aid agreement amendments, most African countries recently have gone through the motions of enacting legislation outlawing slavery. All this means in practice is that the slave dealers must pay bribes to the politicians or the police in order to avoid interference with their business. Now, the news story I mentioned appeared because the London-based group Anti-Slavery International has just released a report detailing the latest facts and figures for child slavery in West Africa. Do you wonder why you don't see more news about the slave trade? Do you wonder why the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal and the major television news networks have virtually nothing to say about it? Can you imagine the outrage you would see in these controlled media day after day and week after week if white people were behind this trade in black children? Of course you can. But news about blacks in Africa behaving the way blacks always have behaved, whether it's in buying and selling child slaves in Nigeria or engaging in ritual cannibalism in Liberia or the necklacing accused witches of South Africa, its news doesn't fit and is therefore deemed not newsworthy by the masters of the controlled fake media. In fact, the media masters consider such news positively harmful because it conflicts with the image that they built in the minds of the white public, an image of virtuous, peaceable, freedom-loving, industrious, sensitive, and creative blacks, essentially noble blacks, who have failed to rise to the cultural level of Europe and America only because they have been enslaved and exploited by the cruel, greedy white supremacists. It's important to maintain this deceptive image because it reinforces the sense of white racial guilt. It helps keep whites convinced that they owe something to non-whites, that they must never think of their own racial interests or feel any sense of white racial solidarity, because that can only lead to terrible things like slavery and oppression of noble blacks. Actually, the media masters have quite different reasons for wanting to keep whites thinking about racial matters confused. If whites ever begin to think racially, ever begin to think in terms of their collective racial interests, the way the media masters do, they will be much more difficult to control. And the media masters themselves will be in grave dangers. So that's why we hear so much about the media and about the evils of white racism. All the need for the government to crack down on what the media bosses call hate, and the importance of giving the poor blacks a few special advantages like affirmative action to make up for the way we mistreated them in the past, and the correctness of pressuring the Swiss people into coughing up as much gold as another poor oppressed minority group demands. And it's also why we almost never see or hear anything about black slavery in Africa today. And more generally, about what all these wonderful minorities with which we are blessed are actually like, and the way in which they really behave when left to themselves. I've done quite a bit of thinking about this problem of the Jewish control of our news and entertainment media, and I've probably talked more about it in on the American Dissident Voices broadcast than any other problem we're facing as a people. That's because it's the most important problem we're facing. It's the key to all our problems. It's the one problem we must overcome if our people are to survive. Let's look today at a couple of aspects of this problem of Jewish media control that I haven't discussed much in the past. What I have discussed often before is the fact that most people aren't really rational in the formation of their opinions and attitudes. They don't believe what makes most sense. They don't believe what they see the best evidence for. They believe what is fashionable. They believe whatever they think other people believe. And so the task of the mass media is not primarily to present either factual or contrived evidence for a particular point of view. They want the public to adopt. Instead, it is simply to convince the public that this point of view is fashionable, that it is the point of view most other people already have. And the media do this convincing primarily with the advertising and with the entertainment. They show fashionable actors expressing the opinions they want the viewers to adopt. Sometimes they use news for the same purpose. They'll sample the reactions of people on the street to some event in the news and select these reactions for broadcast or publication, which match the reaction they want the public to have. But the main task of the news media is to screen out facts which don't fit and present only those facts which seem compatible with the opinions of the media, what the media are promoting. And that technique works quite well with most people, but there are many white Americans who are able to think for themselves, who are able to entertain even unfashionable ideas, if that's where the evidence points. Why don't we hear more of these Americans speaking out? Why do so many of them just go along with the falsehoods and deceptions of the controlled media? I believe that a full answer to this question has three parts. In the first part, place, these people able to think for themselves tend to be more successful economically and socially than the average because they're smarter than the average. They tend to belong to the upper strata of our society and society strata whose inhabitants are cushioned against many of the harsher realities of what is happening to our society and who live in an environment where politeness is especially valued. They don't want to be rude. They don't want to be offensive. To point out too loudly the inadequacy of blacks would be considered a bit de classe. In the second place, many whites believe that we should preserve the peace at all costs. They place a very high value on maintaining social tranquility. They know how easily some minorities take offense and how violent and destructive they can be. They know that if a white policeman has to tap a black with a nightstick during an arrest, his fellow blacks may stage a 3-day riot and burn the whole town to the ground. And to these peaceful, loving folks are inclined to tread very softly and leave their nightsticks at home. They'd rather see us white rabble-rousers restrained than give us an opportunity to stir up trouble. After all, they think, as bad as the racial situation is, we have to learn to live with it. We may not like it, but there's nothing we can do about it. Nothing, that is, except things that are inevitable. Inevitably would it entail a great deal of conflict, violence, and bloodshed, and that's just too terrible to contemplate. Our people, unfortunately, have lost a lot of their stomach for that sort of thing over the past couple of hundred years. And Tommy says they haven't lost it in foreign countries where we go in and occupy the whole country and murder hundreds of thousands of people. Our people have dual personalities. They're nothing but peaceniks at home, afraid to do anything, but willing to kill thousands in other countries. And as I said, these folks who have already have a reasonable understanding of the facts, they're not taken in by any egalitarian myths. With them, it's a problem of values, of priorities. Keeping the peace and avoiding violence is the most important thing to them. About the only way you can persuade them to take a stand for their people is convince them by demonstration that blacks are not the only ones who can raise hell, and that simply being polite will not permit them to escape unscathed and avoid violence to their own persons. Finally, I believe that for many independent-minded people, the problem is not being able to see the forest for the trees. What they see is that there are many individual blacks who are intelligent. There are many moral blacks, many industrious and self-disciplined blacks, and many individual blacks who are able to adapt quite successfully and even constructively to a civilized European society. And they also see that there are many white people who are stupid, lazy, immoral, and undisciplined, and are a burden to our society. These independent-minded people are focused on individual blacks and individual whites, and conclusion they reach is that there are some good and useful people in all races in our society, and some bad and useless people of all races. What these independent-minded people fail to do is back off a bit and look at the races as a whole. What they fail to understand is the problem we must deal with is not the equality of the individual Negro who is living next door, or even the effect of the minorities are having on our neighborhood. The problem is what blacks as a race, or what non-whites generally, are doing. To our society and to our race by living among us. And it is quite clear, indisputably clear, that what they are doing as a race, as a whole, is not good. They're destroying our society and our race. That's the problem we must deal with, and all considerations of individuals become wholly insignificant in comparison. Now, I know that's hard for some people to grasp. I know it took me a while to get my own thinking straightened out. I began life more or less as a libertarian, and my primary concern was that the government not mess with me personally, and more generally that people be permitted to do whatever they want to do as individuals. I didn't think much about the cumulative effect of individual actions and individual qualities of society in which I was living. But as these cumulative effects began being really noticeable in the 1960s, I had to start thinking about them. I believe that all of us need to think about them. We need to understand that every race encompasses individuals with a range of characteristics, with each characteristic distributed about some average value in a more or less bell-shaped curve. When we want to think about the effects of mixing two races together in a society, it is these average values we must consider, not individuals. For example, there are smart blacks and stupid whites, a more or latter of these days than in the past, it seems. But the average intelligence for blacks in the United States is between 15 and 20 IQ points below the average white. That's more than enough to make the differences between being able to sustain a modern civilized society and not being able to keep it from sliding back into the jungle, the way every black country in Africa for which whites build a civilized infrastructure began sliding back into the jungle as soon as the whites relinquished control to the blacks during the decolonization period after the Second World War. More than that, the rare individuals who have special abilities required to build a civilization, not just sustain one, are way out on the high side of the bell curve. Far enough out, in fact, that the black bell curve has, for all practical purposes, gone to zero, which is to say that if on the white bell curve, for an average population of 1 million whites, there are 100 who are qualified as civilization builders, as true innovators. Then on the bell curve for 1 million blacks, the number of individuals who qualify as civilization builders is somewhere between zero and none. These are the things that people who are able to think for themselves need to consider. They need to consider the overall effects of allowing large numbers of blacks and other non-whites to live among us. They need to consider the ultimate consequence of such a policy. They need to realize that as races with lower standards of performance than ours mix with us, they inevitably will pull down the overall standards of our society. Eventually, they will pull us down to the level where we cannot compete effectively with other societies which have maintained their own standards. Our independent-minded people need to think clearly about the ways in which our society already has been degraded by permitting larger and larger numbers of non-whites to live among us. They need to look at the school problem and our crime problem and our drug problem and to understand that these are consequences of our failing to maintain a white society and that they are suffering these consequences regardless of the fact that there are many individual blacks who cannot be blamed for these problems. They need to understand that it is blacks collectively, blacks as a race, who are pulling society down. Our people need to understand the true motivations of the media bosses when they respond to these problems by trying to obscure the problems and confuse us about them, for example, by campaigning against IQ testing or any testing of people which distinguishes them or ranks them according to ability and therefore reveals the fact of racial inequality, and at the same time by trying to convince us that there is some mysterious benefit to be gained by having more racial diversity in our society, when they deliberately try to make us feel a sense of racial guilt by blaming black slavery on whites, when they deliberately use the media to encourage miscegenation, and finally when they make the claim that there really is no such thing as race, that the whole concept of race is meaningless. Yes, we need to understand what these Jewish media bosses are up to. We need to understand the overall consequences to our people of permitting them to live among us. Finally, let me leave you with this thought. If the idea of inferiority, superiority bothers you, if you don't like the idea of categorizing black society in Nigeria or Uganda with its enduring institution of slavery as inferior to our white society, just think of it as different, and just realize that when people from a different race are mixed with ours, we will become different. We will lose our racial distinctiveness, our very ability to think of ourselves as a race. That is why I'm opposed not only to the presence of blacks and Jews in our society, but even the large-scale presence of races I respect, such as the Japanese. Mixing leads to the loss of distinctness, to the loss of identity, and the loss of identity leads inevitably to death. Think about it. Well, there's Dr. Pierce speaking from the grave with very true, in fact, exactly true. Well, as I close out, I want to include the one of the biggest problems, if not the biggest problem we've got, is religion, Christianity and Judaism, and now Islam, because they're all fake religions, they're all phony as hell, and they're all totally destructive to our race.
Many people imagine Jesus as a really nice man, offering kindly words of hope and reassurance to the poor, the desperate, and the lost. Isn't he the guy who preaches love of neighbour and of enemies, of going the extra mile, of forgiving 7 times 70? Surely these are the words of a great humanitarian, of a supreme moral teacher. Well, sorry, pal, this supposed paragon of moral virtue is an illusion. When you remove the cotton wool from your eyes, you will realize that the stylized character of Jesus the Lord is a rigid, intolerant authoritarian spouting a venomous creed, simplistic and cruel. Let's begin with one of Jesus's most celebrated dictums, love of enemies. As it stands, that idea has always struck me as a most ridiculous precept. At best, it is an extravagant exaggeration of a simple enough principle. Treat your opponents with civility, your enemies with humanity. The Greek philosophers were certainly attuned to such notions of moral virtue when dealing with their adversaries, long before similar words were put onto the lips of Jesus. But what would love of enemies really mean? Let's be guided by Jesus' own behavior. How does Jesus himself deal with his own enemies? Throughout the Gospels, Jesus runs up against those notorious scribes and Pharisees, who, quite reasonably, question his odd teachings and behavior. How does the Lord from heaven respond? With love? No, on the contrary, with curses and with threats of eternal damnation. The man famous for his condemnation of hypocrites is himself a hypocrite. Jesus makes abundantly clear that his love of enemies extends only to those enemies who have fallen at his feet in abject submission. He deigns to love them only because they humble themselves before his absolute lordship. He that believeth not shall be damned, says Mark. And just as Jesus' so-called love is indiscriminate, so too is his retribution towards those who don't immediately bend their knee. Jesus threatens destruction and everlasting torment to entire cities for their reticence to immediately embrace him as their new Lord and Master. Or, as Matthew puts it, it will be more intolerable for them on the day of judgment than the land of Sodom and Gomorrah. What we have here are the brutal ethics of a pre-modern warlord, poised before a besieged city with his murderous horde. Immediately embrace me as your king, and my mercy will allow you to live on as a slave in my kingdom. Or else every last one of you will die a horrible, lingering death. And this is a Jesus, a character presented to young children as a figure worthy of reverence and worship. But let's move from enemies to those nearest and dearest to us, family. Again, we see in the Jesus figure that same streak of simplistic intolerance, lacking any normal human compassion. According to Matthew, Jesus allows divorce, to a man that is, solely on the grounds of his wife's infidelity. According to Mark and Luke, not even is that option allowed. Any remarriage is an act of adultery. Now, this is a cruel, simplistic, and wrong ethic. If we were to follow these teachings, as the church in Europe did for centuries, married people would almost certainly face a life sentence of domestic violence, physical and psychological abuse, and sheer misery. Today, we recognize the limitations of marriage. We are enlightened. The words placed in the mouth of Jesus are the sentiments of a primitive, barbarous culture. Could we say that Jesus is the upholder of strong family values? He does, after all, preach the brutal doctrine that the person who speaks evil of his father and mother should surely die. But let's get real here. Might not some children have perfectly good reasons for not honouring their parents? From end to end, the moral code of Jesus is crass, simplistic, and above all, irrelevant to the 21st century. But then again, at least let's take comfort in the fact that it isn't true. It isn't history. It's just more astounding rubbish from the New Testament.
Of their supposed heroic origins as a minority persecuted for their honest and simple faith in Jesus as their Lord and Saviour. We've all seen those movies. The Christians, with their calm forbearance, wearing their whiter-than-white tunics and eyes uplifted towards heaven, suffering in silence the blows of sadistic Roman guards and the teeth of savage beasts. Thousands upon thousands dying for their faith, yet by their willing and noble sacrifice, winning a martyr's crown for themselves, and in the process tempering the harsh Roman culture by showing the truth and superiority of their religion over paganism. This fairy tale shows up in apologetics again and again, usually in that appalling soundbite, "Would they have died for a lie?" Now, before Hollywood brought its own particular magic to the fantasy, centuries of monkish scribes painted an even more fantastical picture in words, the lives of the saints. In these lurid tales of suffering and triumph, survival from beheadings and dismemberments were commonplace. The whole genre had all of the fantasy, but none of the grace of Harry Potter or Tom and Jerry. So where do serious Christians get their information from?
How has it become an assumption, rarely if ever questioned, that the early Christians were persecuted, that they died for their faith? How is it one of those things that everyone knows but can't explain how they know? The first historian of the church, Eusebius, bishop of Caesarea in the early 4th century, devoted great attention to the so-called martyrs of the faith. Yet even Eusebius could count only 9 bishops as martyrs and fewer than 2,000 Christians in total. Now, 2,000 people is not an inconsequential number, but across 300 years, that's fewer than 70 victims per year. Divide that number across almost 100 provinces, and you can see that persecution claimed fewer lives than strikes of lightning. Of course, persecution never occurred across 300 years, nor in all the provinces. The Western Empire was largely untouched by either persecution or Christianity. The first real persecution was during the reign of Emperor Decius in the mid-3rd century. This persecution had all the savagery of requiring Roman citizens to pour a libation for the health of the emperor. Some Christian fanatics refused. Yet Bishop Origen of Alexandria was able to record that in fact God protected the Christians and restrained the rage of their opponents. Those who died, said Origen, could be easily counted. Eusebius later added that God permitted the occasional persecution for the sake of discipline and correction of the brethren. The later years of the 3rd century were known as the Peace of Gallienus, when churchmen actually began to frequent the imperial palace. They owned property and began to gain political influence. In fact, the only true persecution was in the closing years of the reign of Emperor Diocletian and of his successors, Galerius and Maximinus. These emperors were frustrated by the negative influence that the Christians had on the army. Secret assemblies carried the death penalty, and church books were confiscated for burning. The persecution lasted less than a decade. In short, the persecution of the church as a sustained and bloody policy of the Roman state is a lie. The persecutions, so-called, were an invention of Holy Mother Church, fabricated for its own greater glory. It isn't true. It isn't history. It's more astounding rubbish.